Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A couple weeks ago at the CNN Tea Party Republican presidential debate, CNN host Wolf Blitzer asked Congressman Ron Paul what should be done when an uninsured person becomes critically ill. Who pays for the treatment?
That's what freedom is all about, taking your own risk. This whole idea that you have to prepare and take care of everybody.
But Congressman, are you saying the society should just let him die?
No. Yeah.
Okay, that sounds cold, uncivil, according to some. But is it? Doesn't the audience have a right to express their dissatisfaction with the current healthcare system? Why is an opinion bad? When is an opinion bad or uncivil? What makes something uncivil, and what are the implications for our democracy? Coming up later, Kevin Boyle, he's an OSU Distinguished Professor of Humanities in the Department of History. Also, Jim Leach, former congressman for Iowa and now the ninth chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Joining us now, David Eisner. David Eisner is the president and chief executive officer of the National Constitution Center, the only American organization dedicated to illuminating the ideals of the U.S. Constitution and inspiring active citizenship. David Eisner assumed leadership at the center following a five-year tenure as CEO of the Corporation for National and Community Service. Welcome to the show, David Eisner.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. For our listeners, here's a question. Is the apparent incivility a symptom of the problem, or the problem itself, or part of the solution to what ails our country? Give us a call.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask our listeners to hear what they had to say. But what do you think, David Eisner?
I think it's all of the above. I think America has had very robust debates throughout its history, and we've had name calling and challenging elections and so forth. But there are historians and others that say that we've never had such a protracted level of incivility in the history of the country, except in the run up to the Civil War. And I think that we're seeing incivility can work in some instances. It's very hard, for example, if you're an underrepresented minority during the civil rights debate, if people are saying, let's be civil, and what that really is code word for shut up and sit down. And there are times when civility is used simply as a way for people in power to keep people who are not in power from expressing their opinions. But there's also times when we need to worry about the level of dysfunction in our government. And today we're at a time where clearly our government is not working well, based at least in part on the fact that our leaders in government are not able to hear, recognize, and respect each other. And so, therefore, civility becomes a critical factor in being able to get our work done.
Part of it's the media, and I'm not talking about the news media per se, but the mediums by which we communicate. In other words, you know, if we could find those people in that audience that you know, said yay for letting somebody die, if you could talk to them one-on-one, they would say, well, I didn't really mean I wanted somebody to just die. That's what's happened over and over again when somebody has been identified as doing something like that. They say, well, I really didn't mean it that way. What about that instant, you know, that 24/7? The instantaneous news cycle, the YouTube society that we're in now?
I personally don't find all that much to worry about when I hear audiences and speeches cheer at what you think of as sort of political red meat statements. There clearly is a group of folks that are fed up with the idea that every time a person meets a challenge, that government has to step in as the answer. And I think that that's the kind of cheers that you hear in the audience. Frankly, people in an audience don't hurt our country when they act more raucous or more incivil. However, when a elected representative is unable to control themselves, then you have a much deeper challenge that actually gets to our ability to get our work done in government.
My guest is David Eisner. He's president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. We're going to be talking about a program from last week and a program from last March coming up. What do you think about incivility and democracy? Is it a necessary evil? Is it an evil at all? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook, or tweet at Ann Fisher WOSU. Last March, the National Constitution Center played host to a conference on civility. You brought together thinkers from around the country, educators, and a spectrum of activists and more. I was there. I participated to have a conversation about civility and democracy in America. What did you take away from that event? It was about a couple days of talking and conferring and mulling all sorts of ideas revolving around civility and democracy.
The weekend that was entitled Can We Talk? A Conversation about Civility and Democracy in America really illuminated for me that we have very broad agreement that something is not working right in America. We also heard, though, especially from some Tea Party activists, that they believed that when some people are saying, please be civil, that what they're really telling them is to sit down and shut up. So and we had a useful discussion about when is civility most important for getting our work done, which is in the context of really governing, and where we need to allow incivility to operate as a force for being heard, and that's generally more when people that are less in power are trying to make the case for why they need to be heard. If we keep both of those things in mind, then I think that there was a broad and unanimous agreement that a lot more could get done in Washington if people were able to listen to each other, able to respect each other, and not assume that because somebody has a different point of view than them, that they're necessarily meaner or stupider.
When you talk about governing, do you mean governing literally, or does it also include campaigning and campaign seasons when politicians who also might be elected officials running for re-election or people who want to be elected officials are campaigning to become elected? Is that the same thing?
It's not the same thing. Look, it would be much better to have more civil campaigns, and we would find that there would be a translation between the civility that happens during a campaign and effective governing. But the fact is that they're not the same thing. Campaigns are about trying to tell your base and other people that you are more trustworthy and likely to support the people's point of view than the other guy is. And however you say that, that's a tough, rough and tumble set of messages to work through. When you're governing, however, and you're literally sitting down at a table to do the people's business, and you're not trying to convince someone that you're better or the other person's worse, but instead you're actually trying to do what's best for the country, that requires a whole different level of civility. And part of what we've seen is a bleeding, if you will, from a campaign rhetoric into governance.
Last week, the National Constitution Center had another event. They awarded the Liberty Medal to Secretary Robert Gates, and he had something to say about civility. Tell us about that.
So we were so excited. The Liberty Medal is an award that we give every year to individuals that strive for freedom and uphold the values of the Constitution. We've given it to folks like Tony Blair and Nelson Mandela. And we gave it to Secretary Robert Gates, who's the only defense secretary in history to serve presidents from two different parties. And in this case, he went from serving as defense secretary for George W. Bush to serving as defense secretary for President Obama. And both of them believe that he did an admirable job, which in today's environment is pretty amazing. And he gave a very hard-hitting speech that made a few important points. He, while noting that vitriol and nastiness in American politics is nothing new, he also said, quote, "We are now in uncharted waters when it comes to the dysfunction in our political system." And he said, "I am more concerned than I've ever been about the state of American governance." And he put all of that at the feet of America's inability to work through civil discourse and for politicians and leaders to operate in a bipartisan and compromising way.
It's worse than ever, but dissent, you know, it's also, it's a core value of our nation, something protected in the Bill of Rights, but it changes shape, it seems like, across the eras. Is that why we don't always recognize it for what it is at the time, do you think?
It's very hard to recognize dissent, especially if you disagree with it. But America has a long history of struggling to allow more speech to overcome bad speech. But again, I think that allowing underrepresented groups to express their dissent is a wholly different issue from having members in our Congress and in our White House who are not able to listen to each other with respect.
Dale in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You're talking with David Eisner, President and CEO of the National Constitution Center.
Hey.
Hi, Dale.
Props to the Constitution. Hi. And about civility, and it's basically simple and brief. One of my personal American heroes, and possibly a true American hero, was John Glenn. He served in the military. He served in NASA. He served in the United States Senate. And years ago, when he decided not to run again, and they asked him why, he simply said, "There is no civility in Congress." Now, that was a long time ago, mm-hmm. and it's only gotten worse. And I really think that it has reached a crescendo whereby which the people in this country are so disgusted with the fact that it's not where the government works, or too big or too small, but does it work? And it doesn't work. I really think this next election is going to be historic and surprising. Very surprising, because the people just want civility.
Thank you, Dale. It makes you wonder, David Eisner, whether some people who would be great at governing don't get into it anymore because they're driven away by the same things that John Glenn said he was.
I think we're seeing that all too often. First of all, we're seeing that people that would be really good governors our leaders feel that they're less effective at campaigning, and then we're also seeing that people that would be really good leaders don't have the stomach for the kind of tough campaigning and negative, uncivil campaigning that people can expect these days.
Well, David Eisner, I want to thank you for joining us today in our conversation about civility and democracy.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
It's David Eisner. He's president and CEO of the National Constitution Center. Coming up, we'll hear from Kevin Boyle, history professor, Ohio State University history professor. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The economy stinks. Many can't find work. Congress and the president are more unpopular than ever. On the right, the Tea Party and other groups give voice to that frustration and get some results. On the other side, I'm Neil Conan. What happened to the left? Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins later today from 2 until 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Partly sunny skies today, a high of 71 degrees. Right now it's 58 degrees in downtown Columbus. There is a chance of rain for tonight, a low of 51. Rain is likely on Wednesday and a high of 67.
Support for 89.7 comes from COSI, presenting NPR's Neil Conan as he hosts The Evolution of Religion, a panel discussion about the intersection of science and religion at COSI on October 5th at 7 p.m. More at COSI.org.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. We're talking about civility in democracy. Joining us now is Kevin Boyle, a humanities distinguished professor in the Department of History at Ohio State University. Kevin Boyle is the author of Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. When I introduced him last week during a discussion with documentary filmmaker Kem Burns and Lynn Novick, the description and the list of accolades was much, much longer, but we just don't have time. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thanks for having me on, Ann.
Incivility in our democracy is nothing new. Seems like we're often in flux.
Yep.
Are there any other periods comparable to ours, though? You heard David Iser say that Secretary Gates thought it was unprecedented.
Yeah, and I don't quite agree with that. I'll politely disagree with that. There have been all sorts of periods in American history where incivility has taken root in American public life. I think of 100 years ago where the most rabid forms of racism were commonplace in American political discussion. There was an entire 6-7 year period where the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s was enormously powerful. Think of McCarthyism in the 1950s, where it was okay in the Senate to accuse public officials of being traitors to the nation. So there have been a lot of periods where discussion and debate have gotten way out of hand. But that's not to say that this period isn't a really serious situation.
I mentioned to David Eisner, and I'll repeat the comment that dissent, the dissent is a core value of our nation, and that sometimes it changes shape across the years. We don't see it for what it is at the time.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think, and I agree absolutely what Mr. Eisner was saying, that sometimes saying civility is a way of saying to people who are on the outside that they shouldn't be part of the discussion. And that's a danger when you're talking about civility. But you can't confuse dissent and incivility. Dissent isn't always uncivil. One of the most powerful movements in all of American history, the Southern Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s, was profoundly, deeply committed to civility. What the forces of the Civil Rights Movement said they were trying to do was they were trying to transform the South through the power of love. And the incivility of that era wasn't on the dissent side. The incivility was in defense of the status quo. So dissent and incivility aren't incompatible.
David Eisner also made the distinction between the people who govern us that incivility is one thing, but when you're a leader and you're in a position of governance, that's when it becomes a problem.
Yeah, it's a tricky distinction to make because those two sides play off of each other. When you listen to that debate a couple of weeks ago where Ron Paul said, well, people have to be responsible for themselves, and the crowd cheers at the thought of somebody dying because he doesn't have health care. Well, of course, that then feeds the politician's perspective. They hear that line, that kind of argument plays well. So it's not as if those two sides are completely distinct from each other. They're interacting with each other.
So in a case like that, let's just say hypothetically, and I would imagine Ron Paul doesn't want somebody to die because they don't have insurance. What is his role at that point then?
Yeah, that's a great question because it seems to me that what he needs to do is he needs to then talk to those people who are cheering at such a thought. And he's got to say, look, we've got a commitment to each other in this country. That's one of the foundations of the country is, yes, you have individual rights and individual responsibilities, but you also have commitments to each other. And we can disagree politely, hopefully, about the nature of those commitments, how those commitments should operate. But the fundamental premise is we're committed to each other, to a common good. And John McCain ran into this problem during the campaign in 08, where some members of his audience were saying things and screaming things out that were really deeply offensive. And he had the courage to stand up to that and say, we don't stand for that. And that's what a public official needs to do. They have to break that cycle because they got the microphone.
And but nowadays, I brought up technology in our 24/7 news cycle, yeah. YouTube. Anybody has the microphone nowadays.
Yeah. And you have to fill all that time and all that noise. And I do agree with what you were asking earlier, that that's one of the reasons we have such a high level of incivility, because you got to find a way to outshout the next guy, which pushes the level of discourse to some really dangerous levels. You got to find a way to make yourself heard. And one of the best ways to make yourself heard is to shout out over the other guy.
The volume goes up, but maybe the otherwise intrinsic level of conversation can go down.
Oh, yeah.
614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you would like to join the conversation. We're talking about civility and democracy. My guest is Kevin Boyles, history professor at Ohio State University. Corey, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Corey.
Comment. Do you think that the uncivility and divisiveness in today's political climate, do you think that's more party-based than it has been in times past?
Yeah, to some extent, I think it is. I think when I was sitting in my living room last night going over high school government with my daughter's friends, and one of the things that's really happened at the congressional level, which is really new in the last 30 or 40 years, is that both parties have become much more ideological parties. It used to be that you had a conservative wing in the Democratic Party, you had a liberal wing in the Republican Party, and so the parties weren't kind of ideologically coherent. In fact, they spent a lot of time arguing with inside the parties. Now that's changed, so the parties have polarized, and that's added to the incivility. It doesn't have to, but it has, partly because it then intersects with a lot of those other dynamics that we've already been talking about.
Thank you, Corey, for that call. We appreciate it. 614-292-8513 if you want to give us a call and join the conversation on civility and democracy. And Mort, welcome to the show, Mort.
Thank you. Since civility in Congress has a direct effect on our ability to solve current problems, I would submit that if the current Congress were in place after Pearl Harbor, we would have lost World War II. We would not have been able to produce the guns, tanks, and planes we needed in a timely manner.
Maybe we wouldn't even have gotten into World War II.
Well, that's a separate matter.
That's a very depressing thought, Mort.
Yeah, thanks, Mort, for that call. There's a lot of what-ifs and, you know, that kind of a thing going on, but is anything ever comparable to the time you're talking about?
To today's politics? I do think that one really interesting comparison, and a really depressing comparison, is what happened to American discourse and American, and particularly congressional discourse, in the McCarthy era, where a small group of politicians realized the enormous political power they could gain by pushing to the extremes. And we look back on that time now, people look back on the McCarthy era as incredibly destructive. And happily, most of us don't have any personal memory of that time. And so we have a bit of distance that tells us how destructive it can be when you push to the extremes and start to use rhetoric as a weapon against the other side. It just can be an incredibly dangerous thing to do.
I mentioned earlier that you spoke the other night with Ken Burns and Lynn Novick, the co-producers of the new documentary Prohibition. It airs on PBS stations, including WOSU, on October 2nd, 3rd, and 4th at 8 p.m. But anyways, the issue of civility was a factor in the equation that brought about Prohibition too. What happened there? And relate what you just said to that scenario.
Well, the early 20s is another time where incivility kind of grabbed hold of public life, that for a whole bunch of reasons, and Prohibition is one manifestation of the dynamic. American society polarized, and people used the political system as a way of trying to marginalize other people, to define who gets to be an American and who doesn't get to be an American, sometimes literally. So you have Prohibition as an attempt to say people who drink, they're not real Americans. It's that exact period I mentioned earlier where the Klan suddenly becomes a major force, a huge force here in central Ohio. And it was a Klan that was anti-black, but it was also a Klan that was anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic. It was at this period where the great tradition of American immigration was shut down because you didn't want all these dangerous foreigners in the United States. And so in a lot of ways, what Prohibition does is it opens up a window on a period where politics polarized and where Americans saw politics as a way of pitting themselves against other Americans and literally demonizing other Americans. And that's the kind of thing that has infused so much of American public life today. And it's where I disagree with Mr. Eisner that I think what happens down on the ground, what happens with ordinary people in the way they perceive each other, has a huge influence on what then happens in Congress. That in some ways, Congress reflects the sentiments that have taken hold in some sections of the United States.
In other words, something gets thrown out there. If it sticks, they glom onto it.
Absolutely. I mean, you just had Ken Rudin on. It was a great conversation. It was great fun to listen to. But it was also a sign of how there's no distinction anymore between elections and governing. Elections go on all the time. We have a presidential election, what, 14 months from now? And we've got debates on TV. I mean, that's not the way that American elections used to run. Elections have become continual. Everyone's always running for re-election. And so there's no distinction between what you're doing in Congress and your thought about fundraising, your thought about the next election cycle. And so that kind of red meat really plays because you're always running for re-election. You're not looking for the 5 years you're governing and then 1 year you're out running. You're running all the time. And so you get this really kind of dangerous connection between the polarization that takes place on the ground, the kind of extreme politics that can grab hold of headlines, and the election campaign you're running continually.
Yeah, David Eisner said they're very two different things, running for office and then taking office. And one of the things I've noticed people say, well, that's whether it's about Barack Obama or anyone serving, that's not what you said when you were running for office. That's not why I voted for you. Why aren't you doing what you said you would do?
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not, a lot of people don't seem to see it that way, that they don't see the separation.
No, and I think both politicians don't always see the separation, and you're right, the public doesn't see the separation either. Governing is a really tricky thing to do. It's one of the reasons people like me aren't going to do that, because it's a really hard thing to do and you don't want someone like me making decisions for you. And it's a process of compromise that the American political system is set up in a way that minimizes your chances of passing a bill. And I know I'm thinking about my conversation last night on the living room couch. How do you pass a bill? It's really hard to pass a bill, and it's even harder when you have divided government. And what it means is you got to kind of work out the compromises, which is, of course, exactly what we're not doing. What's not happening in a policymaking level is the compromises that get you moving towards something.
Well, that's why what happened last night in Congress was so great, because it was a nice concrete example of log roll. I mean, we'll do this.
Yeah.
You know, Senate got in there and said, well, you know, if you do this or do that, they're not even voting on it yet.
Yeah.
And they're helping create some kind of compromise, which is so rare now.
Yeah. And in some ways, the public, we tend to think of those as bad things. How dare you compromise? Well, because if you don't, nothing's going to happen. We should actually think of that as a positive step. And yeah, it was nice to see it happen once in a while.
Yeah, the definition of civility or incivility, for that matter, seems to be in the eye of the beholder, ultimately. That's one issue. Those cheering when Wolf Blitzer suggested letting a man die if he was uninsured for healthcare were simply expressing their point of view, the same way those protesting in New York City recently were angrily protesting the government bailout of Wall Street in 2008. And those two different sides probably aren't going to agree on a lot of things, but they don't see themselves as being uncivil in their anger and frustration.
Yeah, maybe they ought to. I think it's really important, and it's the tricky ground of this entire question, really. It's important that people have the right to express themselves. And if you give people the right to express themselves, sometimes they're going to do it in really offensive ways. Not often, but often, sometimes, that's what they're going to do. And what happened at that debate for those handful of people, and it's probably only a handful of people,
right,
that's really deeply offensive. that's going to happen, and you got to give them the right to do that. What you don't want is that level of incivility to define the debate. Are people going to be on the margins of a debate saying things you wish they wouldn't say? Absolutely. Do we guarantee them the right to do that? Absolutely. Is that a good thing? Absolutely. What you don't want is it defining the mainstream of the debate, either in terms of the specifics, people should die, people shouldn't die. I mean, who wants to have a debate like that? But also in the tenor of it, where it's better to yell at your opponent. You can disagree. It's better you're going to disagree. Is it better that you yell at them or that you discuss things quietly and rationally? So it's both a question of content and of kind of style. And the dangerous thing is the degree to which that stuff that used to happen on the margins has become a way into the mainstream, where you have a congressman screaming at the president, "You lie." That's the problem.
And I guess another issue is, what is a debate anymore? These things they put on television that are very closely scripted in what questions will be asked and what they can talk about and what they can't talk about. What is a debate anymore? We talk about the debate, but I don't think I've heard a real debate on any topic in a long time.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. And when you watch these debates, which I have to admit, the presidential debates, I mean, it's just way too early for me. I mean, get back to me next September. I'll be watching. Mm-hmm. It's all about the soundbite. It's about the kind of clever thing you can think to say to the opponent. That's not about content. We should have a really strong, vigorous debate about fundamental questions. And that's getting crowded out by all the noise.
And the politicians don't really seem to want to debate. They just want to keep saying their soundbite over and over again in the hopes, as you said, that it'll get picked up and spread around or not. As some of them might hope.
That's usually when you go off the script.
Right. Well, Kevin Boyle, thanks for joining the conversation about civility and democracy today. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me in.
Kevin Boyle, he is a humanities distinguished professor in the Department of History at OSU and the author of Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. It won the National Book Award for Nonfiction. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Coming up, former Iowa Congressman Jim Leach and now chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, Mark Bowden tells us how the Conficker worm penetrated the operating systems of millions of computers worldwide, linking them together into a powerful supercomputer that can be remotely controlled by Conficker's creators. Bowden is the author of Worm, The First Digital World War. He also wrote Black Hawk Down. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Tonight on WOSU-TV, watch the gripping story of the Mexican Revolution of 1910. Learn how that time changed the course of history and profoundly impacted the United States and the rest of the world. Watch The Storm That Swept Mexico. It's tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from Fahlgren Mortein, whose wider perspective on marketing can help your brand grow through advertising, public relations, and a full range of communications. Think wider at fahlgrenmortein.com.
Partly sunny skies today, a high near 71 degrees. There's a slight chance of rain tonight and cloudy skies, a low of 51. Rain is likely on Wednesday, a high of 67, and a chance of rain continues for Wednesday night, a low of 52. Looking ahead to Thursday, partly sunny skies with a chance of afternoon rain and a high near 70. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We are talking about civility in democracy and whether incivility is a necessary part of that equation, or I guess what does incivility even mean anymore? Joining us now is Jim Leach. He's the 9th chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Jim Leach served 15 terms representing Iowa in Congress before his appointment to the NEH by President Obama. He holds 11 honorary degrees, has received decorations from 2 foreign governments, and is the recipient of the Wayne Morse Integrity in Politics Award. Welcome to the show, Jim Leach.
Well, I'm honored to be with you.
A few years ago, you embarked on a 50-state civility tour. How has that gone?
Well, it's certainly been educative for me. And I have not seen a cross-section of the American public, even though I've been in all 50 states. It seems that I run into the most decent Americans there are. Those in the academy, those interested in certain kinds of issues from an issue dimension. And it makes one think that some of the debate that we hear, and whether you call it a debate or exchange of views, is aimed not at the mass American public, but at narrow segments of the public. And that is what one is getting fed into the news of the day. Now, the real debates in America are basically occurring on some of the great editorial pages. And you have commentators from Paul Krugman from one perspective, Charles Krautheimer from another. You have more centrist columnists like David Brooks and E.J. Dionne that are really, and Tom Friedman, presenting perspective to the issues of the day in a context of what matters. What you're hearing in the American political spectrum is what advances a political party's cause, which is very different than concern for common problems or old-fashioned notions like the common good.
So many people rely on television now for their news and their insights. Do you think what the editorial pages produce, what you just described, could ever be replicated?
Well, editorial pages obviously are centered more at a small segment of America. On the other hand, part of that segment are people that project the news from the airwaves in many different dimensions, so they have an effect on opinion makers. The awkwardness of the current times, which is more like some of the 19th century American newspapers and less like the mid-20th century, is that some in the media have taken a commercial take on how to present the news. Instead of the who, what, when, where, and why neutral standard, they're saying, how do we advance a cause that is attractive to a segment of the viewing audience in order to have either out of conviction or desire to have higher ratings. And that is a kind of a new twist on American reporting. On the other hand, it's somewhat understandable. We have a divided public. We have times that are disjointed and in a sense everywhere in the country that the best and the brightest in the political process have to some degree been letting the country down. And now a conversation, which I happen to concur in, that we've had a decade in which America at best has been treading water and quite possibly has actually lost some ground in very significant ways economically and politically in the world.
My guest is Jim Leach, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. If you have a question or comment for him, 614-292-8513 is the number to call. And Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Charlotte.
Yeah, good day. Thank you for taking my call. I thought I'd throw in something about the classic rhetoricians, orators Cicero and Quintilian.
Mm.
The work of a true rhetorician or orator is to search for the truth through debate, not to subvert it. And when the only concern of a political party is to maintain its permanent majority by any means necessary, then don't be surprised when the rhetorical hacks gain precedence. I mean, if you look back, I'm a half-baked Germanicist. And in his day, Joseph Goebbels was considered an outstanding public speaker. The problem is that his most outstanding political quote, roughly translated, was that democracy's most ludicrous attribute was its ability to let itself be destroyed by its enemies from within. So I think, and sometimes I feel like Edith Bunker, ready to scream at the cribs, if you don't stop sniping at each other with your fighting, you're going to ruin the marriage. There won't be a marriage left to save. So here I am stuck between Quintilian, Cicero, Joseph Goebbels and Edith Bunker, and I'm wondering why I'm tearing my hair out.
Thanks, Charlotte.
Thanks, guys.
Well, I mentioned just a second ago, I've been traveling the country being educated, and I think we just heard a classic example of a citizen educating a public. And the educative thought that was just expressed is vastly more profound than one is getting in the American political spectrum. And somehow there's a disjunction between thoughtful citizens and the American political system today, and I think you heard an expression of that.
You're going to talk about coming up this week, by the way. You're going to be in town. You're speaking on Friday at the Ohio Union at 4 p.m., and it is free to the public. If you want to register for that, you can go to the OSU Arts and Sciences webpage, artsandsciences.osu.edu. NEH Chairman Jim Leach will be speaking this Friday, and you can register there for that. But you'll be speaking about civility in a troubled economy. So tell us, you know, how do the economics play into it at this point, and how does it differ to other downturns in the economy in the past?
Well, I think there are multiple interrelationships. Political decisions can affect economic circumstances and vice versa. And sometimes you have decisions that are constructive, and you have times that can have uplifting dimensions despite traumas. I mean, we look back, for example, on the era of the Great Depression, and there was a great deal of angry discourse about political leadership. Perhaps the brightest president of the last century was Herbert Hoover, and yet his presidency was perhaps could be described in many ways as a failed presidency because the economy proved to overwhelm the capacity of government to respond in a credible way. FDR was loved and hated. By the same token, all of America suffered, and one aspect of all of American suffering was that the country came together in many ways, and the government responded with unique programs, many of which are quite positive, from everything from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to the WPA to deposit insurance for in the banking system. On the other hand, you had the country together in partial measure because there wasn't anyone that was triumphing in this difficult times. Today we have a circumstance where we have great social division. We have some doing exceptionally well, others doing very poorly. And we have the middle class, for one of the few times in American history, going backwards, particularly relative to the upper classes. And this is a circumstance that is ready-made for dissent in this country. And that dissent is understandable. How it's being expressed might not be of the highest nature in many circumstances, and I do not think is being well embraced by those in public office in many different circumstances. Although, frankly, at the local level, I think you see more rationality than you do sometimes in a legislative chamber in Washington.
How much do you think that has to do with the fact that there aren't a lot of cameras running all the time at the local level?
I don't think it's a camera issue as much as it is the way American politics is now structured. At the local level, one doesn't think first and foremost that your city council person is a Democrat or Republican. They're there to try to figure out how you manage limited resources in as reasonable a way as one can. At the national level, you have the overlay of personal election or the lack thereof and partisan identification in a significant way. Can be a distorting thing. Now, it's been with us forever, but there are aspects of this that are somewhat novel, and they relate to the news media, which is much more sophisticated and is being directed in different ways than it ever has before, and then to aspects of American democracy, one of which is, and we lose sight of this, that for most people in legislative office in Washington, D.C., everything relates to a primary election, not a general election. Mm-hmm. And primary participation is very small. And in one political party, it's kind of an old-fashioned liberalism that dominates the primary process and the selection of candidates. In the other party, it's kind of a newfangled conservatism that's more of a social conservatism. And it's a very small number of people that are now choosing the candidates. And so the great American center, which has always been the dominant force in American politics and the dominant kind of attitudinal aspect of America, I mean, you can kind of think of the Norman Rockwell kind of America, the Eisenhower America, is now underrepresented to the point of almost being unrepresented in national politics in the legislative chambers of our country.
Dan in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Thank you. My question is, who or what is benefiting from, and you've kind of been leading into this, I think, but who or what is benefiting from the current state of incivility in our, especially at the national level, in our political discourse and what's going on or not going on in Washington?
Well, I don't know if you can quite exactly say who benefits, but one of the clear things is that incumbents in both political parties have certain advantages with this distraught circumstance. Another circumstance is that the people who wield the greatest power within the political parties are beneficiaries, and they may be large financial interests, they may be corporate interests, sometimes they're even a union interest. And all of this has become exaggerated by what in effect is a new law not made in the legislative chamber but by the Supreme Court, and that's the Citizens United ruling that says that corporations can extend far more money in the political process than has ever been considered before. And the definition of a corporation includes a union, so unions will have more power in the Democratic Party, corporations in the American political process in general. And so indebtednesses of people that are elected or seek election are often to the interest groups that control the financial system more than the people who click the lever at the ballot box. And that disjunction is a very serious one now in the American political system.
Thank you, Dan, for the call.
Okay.
Brenda in Columbus, you're on the air with Jim Leach, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Welcome to the show, Brenda.
Thank you. I don't hear nearly enough about how the influence of churches on religion by selecting only the social conservative issues and backing the GOP no matter what else goes on, how that impacts the process, because then any other interest group that wants to hurt people, maybe through fracking, destroying the EPA, going to wars, anything else, nobody cares, or you know, killing uninsured people, whatever. Nobody cares because we only care about gay marriage and abortion.
Well, we are very issue-driven. How does that play into the equation, Jim Leach?
Well, I think what the lady is pointing to also is we're single-issue oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And the big issues are that matter are seem to be secondary because one organizes around putting together single-issue constituencies. Now, that may or may not be a continuous thread, as America is indicating that the number one issue for most Americans today relates to jobs and the economy. But still, there are very strong people that have views on social issues that are quite high. Now, it's not as high as the mid-19th century, where the great social issue was slavery, which truly divided the country and, as we know, ended in our greatest war, at least the greatest loss of life of a war in American history. And I don't predict that kind of rupture at this time, but the cleavages in our society that relate to social feelings and can involve religion are real. And that doesn't mean that there is total commonality of all views within all of the religious movements. For example, in the fundamentalist side, there is a growing group of environmentalists that had not been there a decade or so ago, and they're taking great leadership under the theory that God produced Earth that should be protected. And so it isn't that all of the movements are tied into one particular kind of direction, but it's certainly the case that there is a great empathy in fundamentalist churches for one of the political parties today, just as in prior times there have been certain empathy for other church groups in another political party. At one time, the Democratic Party garnered the support, let's say, of 80% of Catholics. Today, that's not the case at all. At one time, activist churches were quite progressive. The great mainstream churches were internationalist to a terrific degree. And you have different moments in time in which you have different ebbs and flows, but certainly the political dominant flow today is on the fundamentalist side in many ways, and some of that is quite uplifting. Some of that someone in politics might find disagreement.
Thank you, Brenda, for that call. We have an email from a listener, just not a lot of time, but he says the amount of disdain by Republicans and the Tea Party for President Obama and the office of the presidency is unprecedented. Every American's right to say anything is protected by the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment, but for governors, members of Congress, etc., to call the U.S. president a liar during the State of the Union or going around saying President Obama is not a U.S. citizen is unprecedented. It would be naive to say that there is no underlying racism and the lack of civility or decorum the country is seeing?
Well, I happen to agree with one aspect of what this observation is that I think is deeply unfortunate to describe the President of the United States as in the way the President is being described in many, many circles, is, among other things, is anti-Christian, and in other ways that his place of birth is being questioned. I think that is deeply unfortunate and tends to be virtually irrational. On the other hand, it's not totally unprecedented. Thomas Jefferson, for instance, was called anti-Christian by partisan critics. At the zenith of anti-papacy feeling in the mid-19th century, Lincoln was charged with being Catholic, which at that time was considered an aspersion. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, at the time of worldwide, not simply German, worldwide anti-Semitism, was called a Jew at a time that was, for many Americans, an aspersion. And so we do have precedents in American history that are unfortunate. Now, the greatest adjective that led to something more unfortunate than has occurred recently was Alexander Hamilton called the Vice President of the United States despicable, which precipitated a duel in which our greatest Secretary of the Treasury was killed by the Vice President of the United States. And that was a legal act of incivility.
Jim Leach, we're out of time. I'm sorry we have to cut it off there. Jim Leach, Chairman for the National Endowment for the Humanities, thanks so much for joining us. Jim Leach will be in town on Friday. You can learn more about it by going to artsandsciences.osu.edu. Thanks for listening. This is WOSU 89.7. This is WOSU HD1 and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.